All right, everyone. Right at the beginning of paper 115. Paper 115, which is old, single column, page 1260.
Just for a minute.
Or is that a sore subject?
All right.
So. I'm just informed tonight, man.
All right, everyone. Okay, so. First of all, let's set the overall stage here. Because we're about to, begin. The finale here of parts 1, 2, and 3. And, long ago we talked about the fact that, it's important to recognize what the Revelators purposely did way back up there at the beginning of part 1. There's 5 papers on the Universal Father. And the fact that there's 5 papers is not a coincidence. It's very purposeful. What were they very intentionally doing there? You go to the Bible, on that core of the Bible, the first 5 books, the Pentateuch. It's the fundamental core of an awful lot of religion on the planet is predicated on that core that rooted in Abraham and Moses, obviously, but that core in the Pentateuch. And so the very first thing that they decided to do with the revelation is give us a new Pentateuch. Give us a new first 5 books. Those first 5 papers on the Universal Father. So that's how they start, the journey. Now we've journeyed all the way through, and now we're about to finish up part 3. And they have the reflection. There's 5 more papers left. And it's a closing Pentateuch. These 5 papers go together. And it's not because a number of them are about the Supreme, and there seems to be this oddball Jesus one, I get a message, just tack that on. No. It's very intentionally 5 papers, creating another Pentateuch, a closing Pentateuch. What is it? Remember how when we were talking about total deity, and they were talking about that there's 2 ways to really understand the totality of the I Am when you begin to split it apart. First is the singular deity, the I Am. And then when you go to the triune deity, the I Am, we had the infinite one, the infinitude, and the infinity. And they, right there at the beginning of deity and reality, there was two different statements. One where they were equating that which is on the oneness end, very fundamentally to the I Am, a core essence. But then they also pointed out that it's not just that which acts, but if you take it all together, that which acts together with that which reacts, the infinite one and infinitude, and you get the totality of that which results, the infinity of that which results, the capital I infinity, they also equated that to the I Am. So they're pointing out that, as you in terms of the way humans can begin to think about total deity, there's 2 ways that you can begin to engage the concept of total deity. The way that they primarily do in presenting the revelation from the infinite one side, there's the other side as well. And we began to explore that when we went through that total deity paper that I put together to try to, give you bring all the pieces in the Revelation together on deity, you know, in one place, so we could really begin to see the bigger picture. It's the same thing here. There's two ends, two Pentateuch ends. Okay, five on the universal Father that begins, and five on the universal Mother to end it. And you got five books. And we've mentioned many times that, you know, when we get into here, we're going to come upon the place, that one place in the book where they very strongly encourage you to pursue more than God the Father. You know, they point blank put the words God the Mother. And five, there's five papers, okay? It's the middle paper of those five. But it's even more precise than that. Notice how right at the beginning of this paper, we have this tiny little, it's not really a preface. You know, it's really just a header note. Just one just brief little statement, a little header note here. Well, if you go to the end of the fifth paper, paper 119, you'll notice there's a little footer note. Anyway, so there's this little header note and this little footer note, these five papers. And then start ranging in from those two endpoints and count the prefaces, the significant prefaces, as sections. Okay? Start counting in from each end. 21 sections. And then there's a section in the middle, the section that has God the Mother in it. It's very precisely constructed. What these five papers represent is to begin to explore what I tried to point out very, you know, definitively back there in the personality survival paper. Remember that whole bit about the relation to the whole and the individuality of the whole? So these five papers, this Pentateuch, lays out the whole. And in the center of that whole is the individuality of the whole. God the Mother. You know, it's that kind of detail, see, is in the Revelation. The more you explore it, the more you just marvel at the mastery of it. To actually construct five papers ranging over all this stuff, see, and it's very, very purposely created in this symmetric fashion. 21 sections, which is, you know, an interesting number just in itself, 7 times 3. 21 sections on each side of a central section. You know, where they talk directly, the only one place in the book where they talk about the individuality of the whole directly. The rest of the time they're wanting you to, challenging you to discover the whole. You know, and then when you really have begun to recognize the whole, like, getting a lay of the land of these five papers, you know, you go, you know, that spot, it's kind of like in the middle, isn't it? It's exactly in the middle, you discover. Okay? Very precisely constructed. So that's, we have a Pentateuch of God the Father, and we have a Pentateuch of God the Mother. See, so what they've, you know, now we recognize that on its face. The challenge is in going through these to really explore, how they reveal God the Mother and what precisely they're trying to get you to recognize about the difference between God the Father and God the Mother. You know, why are the two Pentateuchs so different? It reflects this, you know, the great difference between that overarching deity which is God the Father and that overarching deity which is God the Mother. Other facets of deity, you know, in the way that we can comprehend it, are more localized in character. There's God the Son here, and God the Spirit here, and God the Sevenfold here, etc. But there's two of them that overarch the whole picture. Okay. And so that, you know, that will be our challenge. You know, like for instance, when we get to the seven bestowals, that's part of the revelation of God the Mother. How? See, that'll be one of the challenges there, to really begin to see that. I mean, at the same time, you know, we're going to be talking a lot about the Supreme, you know, and other things too. But there's a bigger picture in play. All right. I'm going to do this little header note here. So you've got the first of these five papers entitled The Supreme Being. As we get into it a little bit, we'll see why. It starts out that way. A lot of you remember when we were going through Total Deity, we were recognizing that, using the expression for an individuality who is God, called the Supreme Being, you're using that when you want to emphasize the he-ness related to the Supreme. So, that should be the first thought in your mind. If Chris just said this is about the revelation of God the Mother, it starts out seemingly on a very father-like note. Why? So we're going to see if we can answer that question, right away as we get in. So let's just look at this first little header note. So it says, with God the Father, sonship is the great relationship. With God the Supreme, achievement is the prerequisite to status. One must do something as well as be something. So now, we know that one of the fundamental twofold expressions that we have always going on is existential and experiential. And you're seeing it right there. We know that God the Father is existential deity. Very, very much so. In fact, that's what is being overarched. It's the existential deity that overarches the whole of infinity. And when we pointed out how they're using the term son and sonship. You are a son of the Father. We are all, regardless of male or female. We don't have a male-female relationship to God the Father. He's no respecter of persons. We're all sons, which is designating that fact that he is bestowed upon you facts that that give you existential character, so that you are, like they're saying, he makes you something. I am makes you something. Now you are, okay, because of what he does. First in truth by giving each of us a personality, which has nothing to do with male and female, and giving each of, and then so we are sons in truth because of that personality bestowal. But now post Pentecost and the universal bestowal of thought adjusters, everyone is not only in truth a son, but in fact, that factualizes that sonship. It's a literal injection, of his substance into us, making us his sons. Okay, and we have that individual relationship. But with the Supreme, achievement is a prerequisite. Now, in the first thing, they started out with the Supreme Being. So what you might be immediately thinking, and you combine achievement as a prerequisite to status with Supreme Being being that which is finally going to be manifest when the finite age is complete. It's what everything is coalescing to, on the deity level, and finally you have the Supreme Being. Okay? Well, there's an obvious, when you're thinking about that destiny, there's an obvious achievement in mode. I achieve a nature which is called seventh stage spirit. And when I do, I am recognized as a son of the Supreme Being. So that's certainly one of the things that, is being implicated in this statement. I need to achieve seventh stage in order to have the status of being a son of the Supreme Being. That's way off in the destiny end. What about achievement relative to conduct now, as opposed to just destiny then? How does that work? Because like we said, I mean, we can't experience the Supreme Being because the Supreme Being is then, our destiny. What's this? What is, relevance does this have to me now? Okay. Well, if I, you know, we've talked about this over and over and over. If I achieve a measure of cosmic consciousness, if I achieve a measure of resonance with the whole, okay, that would, okay, there's an achievement. Is, you know, how does that sentence work there? I mean, I'm recognized as a cosmic citizen. There's my status, at least at some level. I can obviously have higher and higher levels of cosmic citizen status. But I'm, you know, I have a status. I'm a cosmic citizen if I have a some cosmic consciousness. Okay, one must do something as well as be something. Well, how does that work here? Well, the Father makes you something, but then who upholds that something once it's made? Because you, he didn't make you infinite, so as the infinite upholder, he's not upholding that directly. What is intimately upholding your beingness? You know, we know, we've talked about that over and over. The finite upholder, that's the mother. Okay, and see, you must do something as well as being something. So, you know, the Father creates you, the Mother sustains you, and you're going to do something. You're going to take that personality fact that's being upheld, and you're going to engage power. You're going to take that spirit pattern, and you're going to engage energy pattern. You're going to do something. Okay? Do something real. You know? So you're actually going to sync pattern with pattern. You're not going to take a square peg and try to drive it in a round hole. That's not doing something. You know? That's failing to do something. Right? You're going to actually do something. Because you're not going to drive that square peg in that round hole. Okay? So this relationship between God the Mother and God the Almighty, which we know are the two aspects of God the Supreme that they're talking about, that exist, you know, we have now. Now we have a personality power synthesis going on. So just like we have in your soul, you have spirit fibers and material energy fibers that are being woven together, but there are still the two distinct. We don't just have one supreme being. We're no longer the two things that went into it are distinct anymore. You know, like once you fuse with your adjuster, man and adjuster are no longer distinguishable as separate. You know, that's like the supreme being. Power and personality are no longer distinguishable as separate. But that's not now. Now power and personality are distinguishable as separate. God the Mother and God the Almighty coming together into God the Supreme. You know, as an individuality in completeness, the Supreme Being. But it's the Universal Mother and the Almighty Supreme now. Okay? So, just like we noticed that back there when they were talking about the Most High is ruling in the kingdoms of men, right there before the inevitabilities. You know, and we noticed that it didn't just say destiny. You know, it said conduct and destiny. You have a parallel thing to keep in mind here. The Supreme Being is about destiny. But the great unanswered, you know, the moment that you recognize that, it's like, you know, you immediately ask, well, what about my conduct now? You know, how does that work? You know, what am I fitting into now? Not what will I fit into and have a status then? Right? So that's a fundamental way that they're going to reveal the Mother in a contrast fashion like that. You got something right up front, but it immediately begs a question. It's like, well, what about, see, and they want you to ask that question. They're not going to spoon feed that question to you. They want you to recognize that there's a question that is begging to be asked there, and they want you to pursue the answer because you're going to have an experiential discovery then and not an existential revelation. You're going to experientially discover the experiential deity, God the Mother. You know, that aspect of, you know, there's sort of distillations of experiential deity, but there's a thread of, you know, experiential deity that overarches the whole God the Mother. It's not just God the Supreme. You know, those two are, I mean, there's an part of an expression of God the Mother and God the Supreme, but God the Mother is greater than that. Just like God the Father is much, much greater than just the Universal Father. That's just part of God the Father. That's that personality circuit part of God the Father. But there's much more to God the Father than that. Okay? So that's that. Now there's a little bit more preface here. They're like I said, they don't start you off casually here. So I need to give you some preface because they just hit you full bore. You got that tiny little header note. And then immediately you have a section title like Relativity of Concept Frames. Okay? That doesn't sound very, you know, simple. It's like, whoa. Okay, especially if you have any, you know, exposure to science. This is clearly invoking, you know, they're wanting you to immediately think of special relativity when they say that. They want you to think about that whole domain of philosophy that has not been properly addressed in science. So let me just give you a little sense there so that you, you know, appreciate why they would have that label there. When we first started to think about relativity, you know, we recognized that if I move my head this way, you know, you over there looking at me, say that he's moving to my left. But if I think I'm stationary, you know, if I have no way of knowing that I'm moving, you know, if I think I'm the stationary point, you know, I look at you and I say, no, you're moving to the left. Okay? There's an obvious relativity that is, you know, has nothing to do with special relativity and all that sort of stuff. I mean, speed of light or anything. You know, it's just an obvious thing that, you know, that there's a relativity of relationship. You know, that we have a subjective character. You know, if I subjectively I think I'm the center of the universe, then everything's moving relative to me, and subjectively you think you're the center of the universe, and so everything is moving relative to you. Okay? So that's, you know, that's the initial relativity. And that was initially understood in the context of what was called absolute space. The notion was, okay, if we have this subjective relativity, what's the objective framework in which that relativity exists? And the idea was that you had things that were in motion in a vast absolute space. Okay? Notice that the initial concept was very much static. Which is not surprising. I mean, that's what initially seems to be what's going on. I mean, I'm looking at this table and everything's just sitting there, and that seems to be a state of calmness. That must be a start. You know, stasis must be a starting point. So we put our context, our worldview, our frame in which we view all of this subjective character is this stasis of absolute space. Well, along comes the beginning of the 20th century, and we recognize that that idea doesn't seem to be matching with observation very well. And we create a new notion of what the context is for relativity. And even though current physics doesn't recognize exactly what they've discovered, what they've discovered is that it's not a universe of things, static things, that then might be moving relative to a background stasis. It's a universe of motion. And so these motions, these relative motions, are relative to a transcendent, not stasis, but a transcendent motion. You know, and what was it? And they discovered that there was this speed of light motion, this curious motion that no matter what you thought you were doing, subjectively, relativistically, it always was observed to be doing the exact same thing. No matter how I moved my head, I couldn't seem to change what, you know, I thought or what another person thought or anything. It's transcendent of the relativity, but it's not a stasis. It's a motion that's transcendent. And, you know, that's the objective. And also, you know, if they had philosophy going in science, they could have recognized now that that idea that when you have the finite and its relativity and you transcend it for a context, you know, the initial thought was, well, all there is finite and absolute. So if I transcend the finite, the backdrop must be absolute. So they called it absolute space. Yeah. But see, you know, the speed of light is not an absolute motion, it's an absonite motion. I mean, you know, there's nothing about it that screams, I'm an absolute, but it's definitely is screaming, I'm transcendent to the finite. You know, there's nothing that would want to make you call it deity or God or something like that, like it was an absolute. You know, even now, you know, there's, you know, you wouldn't want to call it one of the seven absolutes. Okay? It just doesn't seem to make any sense, you know, that you would put that label of one of the seven absolutes to this motion of light. Okay, but it's obviously transcendent of the finite because it's not a function of finite space and time. It's independent of it. Okay? So, see, if they would have been thinking about this philosophically, they would have discovered it's not a universe of things, it's a universe of motion, and they would have discovered the absonite. They would have recognized that the observations were telling you that there is a, you know, that the transcendent domain is a motion, and that it's it has to be something in between the finite and the absolute. Okay. Now, how does that relate to this? Well, that evolution, see, going, first of all, recognizing just that you're not going to think in dichotomies of finite and absolute anymore. There's going to be some more greater complexity. And, of course, we know through the revelation there's this whole hierarchy. We have the finite, you know, a whole hierarchy of the absonite, and at the top of everything, the absolute. Okay. And everything is a motion relative to those higher motions. Your thoughts are a motion in the mindal energy system. Everything is a motion. Your thoughts are a motion in the mindal energy system. Your subjective thoughts in your agitant mind are a motion. But they're not an island universe. They exist relative to an objective backdrop, a frame of reference, a universal motion above those subjective motions. And that's what they're bringing in here. That's why they would put such an obvious invocation to someone who's schooled in, you know, in physics and whatnot, pointing at the special theory of relativity like that, because they want you to, you know, do what I just did. Go beyond all the limited ignorance and just mere mathematical application of special relativity. Step back, look at what it's saying philosophically, and then recognize the universality of that philosophical recognition and what it says about you and your thoughts. Okay. And so they want you to have that very technical viewpoint in going into this. So let's see where that goes when they start to develop it here.
Okay. So I just want to say that was a terrific introduction.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Yep. Couldn't say it better myself.
All right.
One, relativity of concept frames. Partial, incomplete, and evolving intellects would be helpless in the master universe, would be unable to form the first rational thought pattern were it not for the innate ability of all mind, high and low, to form a universe frame in which to think. If mind cannot fathom conclusions, if it cannot penetrate to true origins, then will such mind unfailingly postulate conclusions and invent origins, that it may have a means of logical thought within the frame of these mind-created postulates. And while such universe frames for creature thought, are indispensable to rational intellectual operations, they are, without exception, erroneous to a greater or lesser degree.
Okay. Now, it's not apparent yet, but you'll see soon why they're starting out so technically like this. There's a lot of stuff here. So we're going to, this isn't meant to be read like poetry. We need to really do this most of the time kind of a paragraph at a time so we can understand what it is they're trying to get us to get before we go on to the next paragraph, or we'll just won't understand at all what they're trying to convey to us. Notice how they start out. Partial. Incomplete and evolving intellects. Right? So they have that. And those would be unable to form, rational thought patterns if it were not for, this transcendent, the very fact they start with the word partial. You think partial, the contrast word is whole. Okay. You're partial. And you couldn't even be rational if you were an island universe partiality. There has to be a whole. There has to be that which transcends the parts, no matter how many parts there are. Yeah, there has to be a whole that transcends the parts. Because there's a whole, and because you're given an ability to recognize, engage that whole, that reality response, the three cosmic intuitions we know are the way you're tuning into the whole, you can create a true universe frame, a cosmic reference frame, in which you're then going to think. That rational thought is going to be predicated on your logical acumen, engaging that cosmos properly, giving you the correct starting point, the correct universe frame, in which you're then going to think about details. But if there was no way for you to establish some sort of a framework, there's no way that this could possibly have order. Now they're pointing out you could have, because by grace there's an initial integrity to your agitated mind. You can create a rational flow. But it means there's some sort of a framework, like they're pointing out here. At the very least, if you're thinking really linearly, notice what they say. Then will the mind unfailingly postulate conclusions and invent origins. Okay, two endpoints. See, an origin and a conclusion. And then, you've got to somehow create those two anchor points, and then you're going to create rational thoughts in between. Yeah. But the question is, are those anchor points, that logic, true or false? Those anchor points could be figments and not facts. If they were figments, they would still work to create this framework in which you could create rational thought, but it wouldn't be correct reasoning. It wouldn't be truly logical. It would be an illusion of logic predicated on a figmentary universe frame. So, see, notice how they've got both the words in there, logical and rational. This is one of those spots where they're really challenging you to begin to think about that difference. And, almost always when I'm talking about it, I'm setting false logic aside, and I'm pointing out that if it's reasoned, it's rational. If it's correctly reasoned, it's logical. If you've used your logical acumen, your first cosmic intuition, to connect into the universal reference frame, then you've got the true starting point, the true framework, and the rational thoughts then are correctly reasoned and not just merely reasoned.
You're saying the the world is not standing on four elephants on the back of a turtle.
But see, yeah, you know, everyone, see, just notice, see, I mean, yeah, there's always some initial cosmology, some universe frame, but you have to create it, or you can't think.
That's great.
Right? You know, and then notice how they end that. They are, without exception, erroneous to a greater or lesser degree. Now, that sounds difficult if your mind is thinking in dichotomies. Sounds pretty hopeless, but that's not the way it is. Remember, there is a universal frame of reference, you know, despite what current so-called philosophers would say. There is a universal frame of reference. As it's been revealed to us, it's not the absolute universal frame of reference. It's initially the lowest level, just immediately transcendent of where you are, universal frame of reference. After all, you know, this your psychic circle progression, that's a progression up the cosmic levels. You know, you're down there below that first cosmic level, that's your first universal reference frame, that first cosmic level universal frame. You get up there, now you have an immediately transcendent frame that you're thinking within. You get up to that one, then there's one above that, and that's the frame in which you're now thinking. But each one is universal, even though none of them are absolute. But they all have some measure of absoniteness. They have some measure of transcendence of the finite. To some degree, they represent the whole and not a collection of parts. They represent your relationship to the cosmos, to the supreme.
So that would be like the speed of light.
Well, they're in a, you know, and when you're talking about physics,
yeah,
you know, you've got parts, you know, it's the individuality domain. And so if there's going to be something that's going to be transcendent of those, all those parts, even down to automatons, they're still parts, they're partial.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be some, what's going to, the whole going to look like when you're engaging physics? It's going to be something that has no part-like character. It's going to be something that fills all space uniformly. It's going to be the force charge of space. The primordial force, you know, and what you discover is that whole, that reflection of the whole, when you observe it, it's not static. The one property that you can really definitively measure is a speed. It's a motion. Okay, you know, just like we were saying, that's so. Just as the automatons exist relative to that transcendent motion. And all of their relative motions, you know, all the way down to molecules and everything, couches and whatnot, is all relative to that transcendent motion. Your thoughts are motions that are relative to a higher objective motion. And you're trying to strike step with a higher, more universal motion.
Almost got a question.
Yeah.
So God the Supreme is dealing in the grand universe, and God the ultimate in the master universe? And God,
kind of.
So then God the Absolute is all of the above?
The cosmos infinite?
I'm sorry?
The cosmos infinite?
So paradise all the way through the master universe would be God the Absolute?
But no, I mean, what goes beyond the four outer space levels?
Oh,
which is nothing yet.
Okay.
But one little thing, the first thing you want to challenge there is the God the Supreme is related to the finite. There's all kinds of finite activity going on in the outer space levels right now. And the first thing you notice about them, when they, you know, from what they tell you, is there's a huge finite potential that hasn't even begun to actualize out there yet. The Supreme is related to all that evolution of the material finite out in those outer space levels right now. I mean, the Almighty Supreme. Only because there's not finite personality phenomena, but there's finite pattern power going on out there. Okay, the Almighty Supreme relates to the whole establishing the material foundation, the evolution of the finite, at all in the whole master universe. There will be eventuation of energy, if you will, that a you know, that which transcends the Almighty Supreme, that's related to the ultimate, will be related to. But you're going to set the evolutionary stage throughout the whole Master Universe with the Supreme before, you know, you begin the absentite, you know, story. It's a finite stage that is set, even all the way out there.
So, Chris, does God the Supreme encompass paradise, deity, and Havona perfection? Or is it really starting from Havona out, past Havona, into the super universe?
It's more the latter, and let's go forward and you'll see how they start to develop that. We need to kind of let their story unwrap that question. Because I'll be kind of jumping ahead to do that. Okay, so anyway, so, you know, just that's that whole bit about challenging yourself when you see erroneous to a greater or lesser degree. Don't think of it in such dichotomy terms. I mean, obviously, no matter how transcendent I might be able to get my universe framework, you know, that encases my thoughts, that framework is not absolute. You know, so it isn't absolutely true. It's, you know, it's relative to absolute truth. You know, so it's erroneous to a degree. But that doesn't mean it's not true at the level that it's at. You know, at that lowest measure of the whole, it may be perfectly true. But it's erroneous relative to the absolute.
So,
Well,
comes to mind why we have fundamental disagreements with others. Because if I have my frame of reference, which is subjective to some large degree, and they have their frame of reference, I might be wholly logical to myself. They may be wholly logical to themselves, but we can't relate because we have no common frame of reference.
Right, and see, that's what's coming through there. I mean, it will be everyone's thoughts will have a logic, but it's sad to record, remember, that almost all logic is false. It's sad to record that so few persons take delight in cultivating a framework which is objective and true. If I, no matter how low it is, if you and I have a relationship to an objective framework that has fact, that's predicated in cosmic fact and not figment of my mind, that will be in common. And we will have, we'll be kindred minds to a degree. The extent to which we aren't kindred minds and only at best kindred spirits is the extent to which it's sad to record. That we have, see, we haven't recognized beyond the Father. You know, if you've recognized the Father and I've recognized the Father, there's some kindred spirit there, very literally because of our adjusters. But kindred mind, no. I can be an island universe and you can be an island universe with a figmentary logical framework and you have a different figmentary logic. You know. And there's no kindred mind phenomenon. That's what's sad to record, that so few persons have challenged themselves. And see, in the voices now for over 100 years have been, there is no universal frame of reference. You know, you can Google that, you know, and see that statement. You know, we have proved now that there is no universal frame of reference. What are you doing there? You're participating in the sad to record. You're rejecting your connection to the cosmos as an initial assumption. You're assuming there is no Holy Spirit. There is no God the Mother. There is no cosmos. There is no whole. You know, and then you wonder why you can't even agree on what's supposed to be part of just your grace relationship with the Holy Spirit, common sense. You've rejected even common sense. Okay? 'Cause that's your initial, you know, relationship primarily to the first cosmic intuition. You know, you're given an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, all three cosmic intuitions, by grace. Your relationship to your thought adjuster and the Spirit of Truth is almost wholly limited by your choice. But you have an initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit by grace. So that, because you have to have a frame of reference, like they're just saying, in order to have rational thought. And it would sure be nice for the stability of the universe that God created if that, all those initial frames of reference weren't false. See, so by grace alone, everyone is given some measure of a true universe frame so that there's some correctness to reason. But it's sad to record that people get too smart for their own good. They cease to be, as Jesus said, you must become as a little child, where you have that universe frame that's true by grace. You have to go back there. You have to stop actively rejecting the grace of a true logical framework in which to think, you know, in favor of your favorite set of initial assumptions. Okay. You don't have liberty to choose the initial assumptions. The belief that you do is false liberty. It's the Lucifer descent. Okay? The frame is, you know, you have no choice in it. God created the frame, and it is. And either you recognize it and identify with it and discover eternity, or you reject it and cease to exist. We have no choice of the frame. The frame is. See, we are, and it is. And the two existential facts must come together. The fatherness and the motherness must come together as one. Because deity is unity. God the Mother and God the Father, in the last analysis, are one. They're God. Okay? The frame of reference and your personality must become one. The ideals and the facts must become one. The supreme is a power personality synthesis. On and on. It's one of the biggest components of the whole revelation, that recognition. And like we've pointed out, there's a number of things where they immediately are trying to get you to recognize that. Right now, you and I, you know, think we can vote and decide our own government and all this sort of stuff. And to a degree, we can. But you get to the first mansion world, and you don't get to vote on your government. You don't get to vote on the frame. The frame is. You live in it, or you die in it. It's only two choices you have. You know? And to just face that fact and not be afraid of that fact. You've been given everything that you could ever need from here to eternity to have that relationship, to ground yourself in the universe frame. There's nothing to be afraid of. Just use your gifts. Just do it. Now, was there a question somewhere that I saw? That's right. Yeah, Andre. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do Andre first.
Let her
say.
No, come on.
Go ahead, Andre.
No, come on.
I don't have eyes in the back of my head.
So,
A comes before P, so Andre goes first.
As you're talking, one of the things that strikes me is not just this idea of where we are, you know, which is really bottom up in a way. You know, we're starting from a limited perspective. We start as babies. Mm-hmm. Everything about the way we evolve is, you know, first of all, developing a very, very limited frame and allowing that to grow so that depending on how and where and how it's all growing, it's growing in many, many different directions. The other side of that that occurs to me is that we don't really become successful until we learn to look at other people's concept frames and understand them well and be able to actually adopt them. And a good case in point would be, for instance, if you're trying to get directions in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, one is it would be advantageous for you to speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. You'd be amazed how many Americans and others don't realize that. Number two, it would be advantageous to understand one cultural predilection in trying to get directions, and that is that no Mexican wants to appear stupid about the place they live. And therefore, whether they know what they're telling you or not, they will give you directions. And if you don't know that in Mexico, you may not be successful in getting to where you're going. Now that requires you to understand another person's concept frame. That requires you to be able to shift, not so much go up toward that way, but to move laterally and understand that there are other ways in which to think that aren't necessarily logical by your standards, but in fact are true. And I would maintain that people like Mo Siegel, who have to navigate corporate boardrooms, understand certain realities of having to navigate those boardrooms, that people that navigate academia understand certain realities about the political realities there, and that somehow when you understand the frame of reference you're in, you behave a little differently, even though it may not correspond to what is normal waking reality.
Right, and the one thing to think there is we go into this, notice the next sentence tying into this. You know, Jesus did that very, very well.
Yeah.
Why? Because he had taken delight in cultivating a relationship with a very high concept frame. And because of that, you can always go back down. And you can come back down in any different way. From that higher objective viewpoint, he knows exactly where, you know, Joan is looking and how. And he can go right there with her. But Andre is looking at the exact same thing from a totally different viewpoint. You know, both have a measure of truth, and both can be engaged by that person who has an objective frame that includes both of those lesser objective frames. Now, if the person is completely an island universe, there's not a heck of a lot that even Jesus could do to go into his reference frame because it has no truth to it, no reality. And so he kept walking. He passed them by. You know, because there was no truth to their logic. You know, and many times, I mean, it was so figmentary, this frame in which they were thinking, that you couldn't even call the thought rational. I mean, if it gets too, you know, arbitrary, the frame in which you think, what happens is not even, you know, called rational. You know, you're insane. There's no way that you can have psychological sanity if you have cosmic insanity. If you have absolutely no relationship to some sort of objective frame, and definitely what's inside is going to be chaos. And there's Pam. You have
okay.
Nothing? Or?
Okay, I'll see.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
What I was thinking was, let's say there's a teenage girl and they're, you know, talking about their lipstick or something like that, or what clothes you're going to buy, or whatever. Some stupid little thing.
Yeah, minor thing, yeah.
And then there's, all these different thoughts that are surrounding our whole universe. So those thoughts, I mean, like, do they clog the supreme? I mean, are they?
Good question.
I do understand what you're saying. We'll see as we go forward and they start talking about the supreme mind and our relationship to the supreme and things. I mean, that's a great thought. Because, see, the answer is no. And the answer is because only those thoughts that you have that have a resonance with the whole fill the thoughts of the supreme. Those ones that don't resonate, you know, don't go up there and clog, the supreme's thoughts. In the same way, see, what you can understand in the macrocosm You know, they told us when we were in the adjuster papers, they told us this same fact in the microcosm. If you have thoughts that are not real circulating around in your subjective mind, they can be worse than erroneous. They can literally be evil. They're so twisted. Those motions that are circulating in your, those will not get reflected into your soul. They don't clog the soul. So your thoughts, you know, you're completely erroneous, you know, even evil, distorted thoughts here are not going to clog the oversoul either. Okay. We all know who studied the Supreme Papers. They a number of times try to, you know, get you to think about the parallels here between, you know, what's set up inside with, you know, your relationship between you and your soul and your adjuster, and what's going on in the macroscopic with the Supreme and the Trinity, and you know, we'll talk about that when we get to it.
Okay. It must not be so sad to record your answer book, or at least the reference to the thoughtless pagan.
Remember what they're really trying to do with the fifth epical revelation. They're trying to get us to go beyond sort of just the station-keeping mode that we're in by grace alone. It's time to, you know, we need to start choosing to go beyond just that measure of grace that has held civilization together in this primitive state for all these millennia. It's time we go beyond that initial relationship with the Holy Spirit. It's time we start choosing a greater relationship. Yeah. And why is it time? Because the Supreme doesn't wait for us. The universe is moving forward, and that forward movement of the whole is beginning to manifest here on this little planet. Remember, you've steamed out of the sheltered bays. Okay, this planet is starting to be moved forward by the Supreme in terms of the facts. You know, so this, you must do something as well as be something. That what you need to do is going to be much greater than it was before, because the facts have become greater. And so you need to be greater than you were before in order to be able to weave to those greater facts. The Almighty Supreme is moving apace. And we have to start choosing to have the cosmic personal character to be able to strike step with that. And that's the other thing, just, you know, before we go into this next paragraph, remember that those reference frames, you know, that we're trying to strike step with, whether they're someone else's or ours or a higher one, they're a motion. It's so important to remember what you're trying to do. You're trying to strike step with that which is moving. Yeah. It's not just sitting there, you know. And so you can very carefully, you know, step on it. And no, it's moving. And the higher it is, the faster it's moving. And the more adept, the more wisdom you have to be able to jump right in that, you know, that faster flow, that more extensive flow even.
And to be able to accentuate that flow instead of killing it.
So, you know, or be killed by it, you know. You'll be, you know, if you jump into the Yellowstone River, you know, it's a pretty raging torrent, you know. We've steamed out of the, you know, at those little places where it's all placid. We've got to go out on the high seas where it can be roiling at times. All right, so see what they say here then.
Conceptual frames of the universe are only relatively true. They are serviceable scaffolding which must eventually give way before the expansions of enlarging cosmic comprehension. The understandings of truth, beauty, and goodness, morality, ethics, duty, love, divinity, origin, existence, purpose, destiny, time, space, even deity are only relatively true. God is much, much more than a father, but the Father is man's highest concept of God. Nonetheless, the Father-Son portrayal of creator-creature relationship will be augmented by those supermoral conceptions of deity, which will be attained in Orvantan, in Havona, and on Paradise. Man must think in a mortal universe frame, but that does not mean that he cannot envision other and higher frames within which thought can take place.
Especially, is that last statement true post-Pentecost?
Right.
Okay. Because go back. The understandings of even deity are only relatively true. Yeah, that's very, you know, that's, you know, the whole point of that string is to build up to even deity. They want to fully challenge you here in this hierarchical structure that they want you to engage. God is much, much more than a father. Not a little bit more, much, much more than a father. Okay, your initial concept of even deity is very limited. And that initial consciousness is mostly of the Father, because that's the laser beam that is engaging you and is hard to miss right in your eyeball. Okay, but other aspects of deity are just as real and just as possible for you to understand and recognize. Or recognize and understand. And for instance, notice this. What, you know, carefully think about this statement that is the last sentence in the book. You notice they repeated the last sentence in the book here. But the Father is man's highest concept of God. It's not your adjuster's highest concept of God. Okay? And why? Most fundamentally, why is it not your adjuster's highest concept of God? Because we finally, when we finally laid out total deity and finally got everything in its place, we understood precisely where, you know, what part of the Father the adjuster is a fragment of. Okay, it's a fragment of the lastly. You know, go to the first sentence, the first two sentences of paper one. And lastly, is an infinite upholder. It's from the aspect of God the Father that is the most removed from the intense infinite one end of the Father. The very I am-like end of the Father. Okay? It's, you know, he dips his ladle into the reservoir. The infinite, remember, if it starts with infinite, it's a reservoir. The infinite upholder reservoir ladles out a portion of himself. But that self is actually the point of contact where infinitely to one side is the whole spectrum of God the Father. And over here, infinitely to this side, is the whole spectrum of God the Mother. The infinite upholder is the boundary, because what we discovered was what is most fundamentally the character of the deity that is God the Mother, in the way we directly experience it as we go up from the finite through the absonite and even to the absolute. It's the finite upholder, the absonite upholder, the absolute upholder. It's downstepped expressions of the infinite upholder. Your adjuster is your key. Remember how he said that a lot of things are going to present in this revelation would be impossible for you even to remotely comprehend if it wasn't for your adjuster. God the Mother is a really, really good example of that. You're not going to find God the Mother just with your personality. You really need your adjuster. You need to bring the adjuster into play. The interface between that personality connection to the universal Father, and you move through the spectrum to the end point of the Father, and then over into the Mother. The adjuster is the gateway to that connection to the cosmos. The gate, you know, the adjuster can really help you, help amplify your relationship with the Holy Spirit so that you can begin to really leverage that and not be so sad to record anymore. Begin to be functioning in a frame of reference like Jesus was. It was so incredibly objective that he could approach anyone and strike step with them right where they were. You know, you notice he didn't say, okay, let's stop everything here so we can both get really static and then I'm going to try to approach you. No, they didn't miss a beat. The guy was moving and he just moved right into step with that person. He knows the flow.
And he thrilled in it.
Yeah. He thrilled in being able to apply his relationship to the greater flow, to be able to engage the lesser flows.
Happy.
And encourage those lesser flows to become greater.
Except for his enemy. So what happened there?
Woe unto you. who would reject the frame of reference.
Oh,
how often he went back to them and said, I will give them another opportunity.
Right.
And kept going back.
You don't.
He kept going back.
He kept saying, you don't want to let go of the frame. Because why? Because when you let go of the frame, you're letting go of the upholder. You will no longer be upheld. And you will fall. Remember, you can't actually fall. You can only choose to not be held. That's part of the great revelation of the fifth epical revelation. It's impossible to fall because there's a finite upholder, an absolute upholder, an absolute upholder, and even an infinite upholder. Where's the crack? Horizontally or vertically? There's no cracks anywhere. It's the full infinite extent, vertically and horizontally, is upheld. Okay? You can't fall, but you can choose not to be held. And he kept saying, don't do it. Don't choose not to be held. You don't want to do that. Yeah.
Just a quick comment on what Pam had to say in reference to, in context to what you're saying here. We will always be trying to move forward. And this sequence that they talk about in here, all of the things that you go through, truth, beauty, goodness, morality, ethics, and so forth, the important thing is not so much at what stage you're at, but that you engage and that you move forward. We're still moving forward, but we move forward on the mansion world. We'll move forward as spirits. The whole objective is to stay in motion. So it's important. It's important, for example, way down the list, when you're 5 years old and your mother says, don't lie, or when your mother says, don't steal. It's a new lesson to you then. You can't skip it. You have to learn it. And as you move forward, maybe you get to a point where you are silly teenager. And you're thinking what we refer to as silly teenage thoughts. But they're not so silly. It's not so silly because when you look at, for example, when you're learning academics, you look at a beginning reader and the stories are silly. But to the child, it's extraordinarily important. You can't skip the first grades of learning to read any more than you can skip the first grades of morality, of duty, of honor. And as we move forward, we learn. So, from a higher perspective, we're still a bunch of silly teenagers.
Yeah.
We're still ghetto children.
But
the point is, we're engaged and that we're moving forward. But you have to remember that you can't skip through one of the lessons. You can't skip through morality. You can't skip through honor. You can't skip through those. You have to go through those before you can move forward. And if you don't, then everything that you base your premise on is even more false than what you have at hand. But yeah, we're kind of limping forward. We're gimping forward, but we're moving. And that's what the important part is.
All right, so just before we read one more thing. There's a partial answer to the question of why did this paper start, or why did these five papers start with a paper that's entitled The Supreme Being? Let me show you how you pull something out of these two paragraphs here. Notice in that first paragraph, they're trying to start you out linearly, because they know that's where you are. Remember we pointed that out, that they that they said that your initial way that you begin to have a frame is a line, and it needs two endpoints. You know, and so there's conclusions and origins. Okay. Now, think about deity in that initial linear reference frame. When you look to the origin point in that reference frame, you see the Father. God the Father, universal Father, your origin. You know, with God the Father, sonship is the great relationship. It started out, okay. That's the origin point on that in that reference frame. What's the destiny point? What's the conclusion point? You know, and conclusions and origins. You know, when all is said and done with the evolution of the finite, it concludes in the complete factualization of the Supreme Being. So, two things. One, the Universal Father is a He, and the Supreme Being is a He. So, that's in consonance. And you can start in a nice little linear viewpoint. Now that's, they know that's basically where you are. So they're going to start you there. It's just like when we were back in deity and in reality. Remember they said, okay, we're going to start as simple as we can here. We're going to start with trying to just do it with the seven absolutes. And we're going to try to get you to begin to understand it with that initial reference frame. Of just the seven absolutes being the initial assumption, you know, the initial framework. You know, but they carefully pointed out a number of times, you know, you've got to recognize this is just an initial suggestion. Okay? It's the most crudest of starting points for a reference frame. There's going to be a whole bunch of things that are going to be very confusing with just the seven absolutes as the starting point. You know, and the confusion just begins with the Paradise Trinity and gets more and more confusing from there. Okay? Because one of the seven is not the Paradise Trinity, and so you've got to try to figure that out. And, you know. And it's the same thing here. They want you, you know, this is an evolutional revelation, not a revolutional revelation. So they start where you are. Linear person with man's highest concept. He. Deity is He. A line with He's at the endpoints. Universal Father and the Supreme Being. That's where they start. But, you know, right in that context, they say God is much, much more than a father. God, deity is much, much more than He. It's much, much more than something can be thought of on a line. After all, I mean, can I really go all the way and connect to the Father? Well, no. The Father's outside of space and time. I'm very much inside. He's, you know, jumped over that gap through the mystery of mysteries and made contact with me. He's really taken that endpoint and kind of brought it into this, into my now. And it's the same way with the Supreme Being. I can't directly experience the Supreme Being. The Supreme Being is the oversoul of creation. The Supreme Being is that which is basically an absonite fact. That has injected into the finite. You know, just like your soul can be a little source of decision motion that can come into your agitated mind. Remember when we read about that? You know, because it's a separate self. You know, the finite domain has this sort of separate self outside of it, the Supreme Being, and it's a completed fact. You know, whispering into the finite, if it, you know, as it were. And so what you really have, you know, when you think about it, is not a line at all. It's a point here that has been bestowed from the two endpoints. The line really isn't adequate at all. Just the moment you start thinking about it a little bit. I don't span that full line and touch the two endpoints. I'm in here in the middle. I mean, right away, you need to challenge yourself. They're telling you, you have to challenge yourself to start thinking non-linearly. Start thinking about not that eternal endpoint and, you know, this near eternal endpoint that way. Think about the eternal now. Think, discover, you know, this achieve a relationship to the non-linear now, where the Father and that He at this endpoint comes in, you know, and it's the Almighty Supreme and the Universal Mother that are directly here. You know, and just when we're talking about personality, it's the Universal Mother that's here. Okay, she is here, the finite upholder is here, and my Father spark, my personality is here, but the Father is not literally here, you know.
In that same line, we talk about having objective perspective, but you take objective perspective and you bring it down, and you bring it down, and you bring it down until you are exactly where you're saying in the eternal now. And the eternal now gets really messy. And we're not as good as Jesus. We can't understand every perspective. So we have to pick our perspectives and work along as best as we can and try to understand other people's perspectives, as Andrea said.
But just start, but just really challenge yourself, though, you know,
yeah,
to not say, I'm only this. You have an adjuster. Grab a hold of that fact. I mean, those who read the Aranchabet give lots of lip service to the adjuster. But it's sad to record that so few Urantia book readers actually take that as a fact. You know, I don't have to be limited to man's highest concept of God. I have an adjuster. I can have an adjuster's concept of God if I so choose. I can begin to discover that God is much, much more than a father. He's supreme. You know, there's God the Supreme, there's God the Ultimate, there's God the Son, there's God the Spirit. And very, very importantly, around the entire infinite eternal ellipse, there's God the Mother. Okay? That's so missing in man's initial concept. You know? There's just the poke, the spark that pokes you. Okay? What holds me? Doesn't God hold me? Does He just poke me? Yes, God holds me. God the Mother holds you. See, that's the big thing that's missing. If you just think about it, in all the history of mankind's relationship with God, that's what's missing. And it's the hardest thing to recognize. Yeah. Because it's the whole. And a part, the first word, partial, the part has a hard time recognizing the whole. Matter of fact, the part can't recognize the whole. But your personality in combination with your adjuster, you know, with the avenues of the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth, can recognize the whole. Okay, now think. You know, this is what has been so lacking. You know, the revelation needs to come alive more. It's not just the fifth epical revelation of the nature of God the Father. Yeah, that is part of what it is, and that's huge. You know, it so transcends any prior revelation of God the Father in the previous four epical revelations. But it's the first epical revelation of the rest of the picture. Who holds me? Am I not held? We need to recognize really why you've been given an adjuster. It's much, much more than just so that you can be not just in truth a son of the Father, and can now, you know, in fact can be the, you know, a son of the Father. Truth goes a long way. You know, It's what it's really there for is to begin to accelerate our relationship with the one who holds us, because it's a substance that is true spirit. It's something that is truly held. I mean, think about if the upholder has spirit hands and you're nothing but matter. You know, when, just think about how much more solidly you'd be held if you grabbed a hold of that spirit substance. Yeah. That's what we want to do. You know, the moment that you fuse with your adjuster, you've eternally gripped it. See, you're eternally upheld. No longer could you possibly slip through any fingers, you know, if you will. You know,
or make a choice not to be
held. See, that's, you know, to begin to recognize what, you know, the fact of the adjuster that goes beyond man's highest concept of God. You know, then you're really going to discover, you know, the great value of Pentecost, of the universal bestowal of thought adjusters. It's so much more, you know, than the previous four epical revelations would suggest, you know, or what you would imagine from them. Okay, one little quick thing.
With God the Mother, there's nothing to miss, right?
It's pretty hard to, you know, if you've engaged the whole to some measure, it's pretty hard to be caught off guard. If you're a part, you can be blindsided. But if you have some measure of relationship to the whole, you're right there. You know, you can think in the moment. And it really helps with, you know, transforming your day-to-day life. You know, if you're just focused on the laser beam, you'll get hit from the side. Okay? But you're not going to get hit from the side if you have a relationship with God the Mother, because you have eyes in all, you know, in the back of your head. And everyone knows mothers have eyes in the back of their head, right? Okay? Right? It's true. You have more than that. You got eyes all the way around. You see the whole. You don't just see the laser beam. Yeah. You don't just bliss out in the laser beam and become an island universe kind of, you know? You can actually, you must do something. You can actually obey the positive golden rule. Do unto others. You know? If there's no others, if it's just you and the laser beam, you know, you can't even follow that simple suggestion of Jesus to do unto others. All right.
In order to facilitate mortal comprehension of the universe of universes, the diverse levels of cosmic reality have been designated as finite, absonite, and absolute. Of these, only the absolute is unqualifiedly eternal, truly existential. Absonites and finites are derivatives, modifications, qualifications, and attenuations of the original and primordial absolute reality of infinity. The realm of the finite exists by virtue of the eternal purpose of God. Finite creatures, high and low, may propound theories, and have done so, as to the necessity of the finite in the cosmic economy. But in the last analysis, it exists because God so willed. The universe cannot be explained, neither can a finite creature offer a rational reason for his own individual existence without appealing to the prior acts and pre-existent volition of ancestral beings, creators or procreators.
Okay, those two, let's just keep going on these other little paragraphs, because these two preface that. You know, you see, all they're really doing, they're setting up this notion of the absolute basis for supremacy. I mean, you know, even though in the last analysis there's no way to fully understand how the absolute downsteps itself into the finite, it's a fact that it has happened. You and I are finite, and God is absolute. So, through the mystery of mysteries, in the whole, you know, the absolute comes down to the finite. You know, there is a framework. You know, like they're pointing out there in the end. You know, the rational reason. You know, you just keep following it back, and there has to be an absolute first source and center of all things and beings. Somehow, it's come all the way down through steps of creation and procreation to me. you know, does everyone appreciate the word procreate literally? You know, the pro word means forward. You know, there's creation, and then procreators are passing that creation forward. They're not creators themselves. You know, the creation is flowing through them. They're passing it forward. All right, why don't you just go ahead and read that? Yeah, that next little one too.
The absolute basis for supremacy. From the existential standpoint, nothing can happen. From the existential standpoint, nothing new can happen throughout the galaxies. For the completion of infinity inherent in the I Am is eternally present in the seven absolutes, is functionally associated in the triunities, and is transmutively associated in the triodities. But the fact that infinity is thus existentially present in these absolute associations in no way makes it impossible to realize new cosmic experientials. From a finite creature's viewpoint, infinity contains much that is potential, much that is on the order of the future possibility, on a future possibility, rather than a present actuality.
Okay, so they're just contrasting there. On the absolute level, it's been absolutely actualized. So effectively, there's a stasis. Nothing new can happen. You know, the cosmos infinite is already in existence. You know, if you go all the way up to the highest viewpoint, it's all said and done. It's all there. But when you swing around to the bottommost, bottom-up viewpoint, where you and I are, it's mostly undone. You know, it's mostly potential, like you're saying. Infinity contains much that is potential. That contrast, that it's absolute actuality, you know, it seems when you look at it here, and it's mostly absolute potentiality when you look at it from bottom up, and just contrasting that to get you started. And so that's what's, you know, that's the spectrum that you're bridging. Somehow that, you know, to get to the absolute to the finite, you have to also transition from that actuality to the potentiality. Now we know that, you know, three of the seven absolutes are reservoirs, potentialities, but that's when we look at them this way. Okay, that's the bottom-up viewpoint of those three. Really the unity viewpoint, you know, they're not called. Remember, we went through that in Total Deity. From the unity viewpoint, they're not called the deity absolute, the universal absolute, and the unqualified absolute. From the unity viewpoint, what are they called? Anyone remember? The infinite potential, the infinite upholder, and the infinite capacity. They're three facets of deity. They're not reservoirs at all. Okay? They're absolute actualities of deity. See, from the unity viewpoint. Okay? So that's what's implied. That's what they mean, you know, the true unity viewpoint of the seven absolutes.
Say those three again.
Okay, the infinite potential.
Okay, which is tied
with the deity absolute.
Right, right.
The infinite upholder is tied to the universal absolute. Mm-hmm. And the infinite capacity is tied to the unqualified absolute.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. And that infinite potential's I am that which intends. Right. The infinite capacity, I am that which extends. And obviously the infinite polar is I am that which upholds.
John's got a question.
I'm confused.
which is always a good starting point for Revelation.
So, when it goes on to qualify it and says that, we recognize it differently, but is it kind of saying, if you really go into it very deeply, that all this has all happened? That the infinite now is the culmination of the ultimate absolute, so to speak, and it's already exists, and we are playing it out in a different now.
To begin to go out of that linear way of thinking and begin to think in a more holistic way, this is the first confusion that you need to have. It's the gateway to a new way of thinking. To recognize that the limitation of that linear time ticking forward from zero to eternity viewpoint, to recognize that the bottom-up and the top-down view are both valid, they aren't in contradiction, and they, you know, sporadically throughout, you know, they give you a direct challenge, you know, like talking about the antecedent following. Yeah. They use that expression. And from a simple linear viewpoint, that's nonsense. There is no such thing as an antecedent following. But if you challenge yourself and use your adjuster, it will help you with this. Challenge yourself to not see that from that limited linear viewpoint in which it is impossible and hence illogical. There is a higher universe frame in which that's not logical. And that frame is always going to be a little bit confusing from here to eternity. But that frame is built by beginning to be able to look up and down at the same time. To use your material consciousness eye, the individuality viewpoint, to look up, and your unity consciousness eye to look down simultaneously, instead of trying to do it with one or the other eye. Weave those two perspectives together and get the three-dimensional real universe. Remember when they actually use that direct analogy? Now that's what they want you to do. They challenge yourself to not pick between individuality and unity. Mankind has done this. Religionists have tended to be very fixated on the unity viewpoint throughout all of history, you know, and have never understood how individuality fits into the picture. And then scientists, or, you know, just sort of matter-of-fact individuals, you know, have been fixated on the individuality viewpoint, the bottom-up viewpoint, and the whole unity thing, whatever. I don't know where that fits in. Just ignore it. you have to begin to think of both, because that's what it means to be a child of the Supreme. That's what it means to have cosmic consciousness. It's when you have both eyes open and you're weaving together. If you actually do something, if you actually achieve a measure of weaving those two together, guess what happens? If you weave those two together, the viewpoint of the two eyes come together in focus in your subjective agitate mind, guess what happens now post-Pentecost? The adjuster copies that into your soul. And you just put a brick in your soul. You just add it to your soul. That's what you have to do. That's what it required.
It's unconscious in a way, isn't it?
I mean, it's unconscious. Man cannot cause growth.
Thankfully.
But he can supply favorable conditions. The favorable conditions are having both eyes open. You know, and if you just reflect on what the cosmos looks like with both eyes open, tells you back in paper 16, section 6, what do you have to do? You know, so it's not sad to record. All you have to do is reflect. The only way that you can reflect, the only way that you can see the cosmos and compare it to your initial subjective self, is to have both eyes open. It's impossible to reflect with one eye closed. Because what you're trying to get the self to reflect is the cosmos. And the cosmos can't be seen with one eye. The laser beam from the Father can be seen with one eye, but not the cosmos. Not God the Mother.
Yeah. I remember reading about Lincoln, and as he got into his presidency, it seemed like he was pondering, reflecting more and more and more on how God's viewpoint of this whole struggle.
Because that's the only solution, is to get up to a higher perspective.
Yeah. Everybody had their own viewpoints, and they took sides. But he was always seeking. He had his own viewpoint too, but he was always had that humility. What's God's viewpoint?
Right, and that's why he said,
how is he looking at this?
You remember, he said, you know, I can't comprehend how someone could take a job like this without God as their nucleus. There's no way they could have the vantage point, the objective consciousness, the perspective in which to see the solutions to problems. It's in, you know, he deemed it impossible, and of course it is impossible. That's, you know, the whole point of the fifth heavenly revelation, you know. This is essential. You must have this cosmic viewpoint.
There's an element. I appreciate what you said about being willing to go through the confusion, because there's an element of needing to, like you're saying, you're suggesting, as arrogant as it seems, taking on the psychology of God or attempting to see it from that point of view. And most theological perspectives have said over all time on this planet,
mm-hmm.
that to do so is arrogant and blasphemous.
Yeah, because they know not about what fact? The thought adjuster. That's why it's not self-righteousness.
Right. So God, in his humility, bestows himself on us. But that's aside.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that strikes me in John's question is the idea of, you know, the first reaction of a human being to that is, well, holy shit, what fun is that? You know, if you know what everything's going to be, what fun is that? So then the next thought is, well, but he did it that way. So there must be something that I'm missing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that very often doesn't, that we don't go to. Mm-hmm. We don't go to it when we're looking at a fellow's point of view. Okay? When we don't take on that other fellow's point of view, we're not looking for it. We're not trying to expand our viewpoint that way. And we're definitely not doing it. If we're not doing it for a fellow, a man or a woman, we almost certainly are never doing it for God. We're almost certainly never trying to take on that added thing that God must be thinking in order to have done it this way.
Yeah. Yeah, and just look how that ties in. Just look, read this next thing and see how they start right off with that. Yeah.
Value is a unique element in universe reality. We do not comprehend how the value of anything infinite and divine could possibly be increased, but we discover that meanings can be modified, if not augmented, even in the relationship of infinite deity. To the experiential universe, even divine values are increased as actualities by enlarged comprehension of reality meanings.
I see. Just the one thing I wanted to point out to you is that first sentence is kind of the challenge in there. I mean, you can think a lot about, you know, the relation, you know, with meanings, you know, is a relationship between things and values and all the consequences of that, what they're saying there, you know, that even with infinite things, you know, that there can be many different arrangements or relationships to one value and hence lots of different meanings. See, but value is a unique element in universe reality. Value is a thing, too. Only it's not an individuality likeness thing. It's a unity likeness thing. And hence it's a unique thing. Is this unique element in universe reality. All they're doing in this paragraph is just trying to really challenge you to think very technically about the relationship between things, meanings, and values, even on the highest levels of when you're dealing with individualities that are infinite, things that are infinite. Mm. So just reflect on that. It's very much meant to be a mental exercise that you take up the challenge. Just the kind of the initial impenetrability of that first sentence is purposeful. It's meant to challenge you to spend some time reflecting on that. Try to see if you can understand the details there on your own. A little homework assignment for, you know, that paragraph. Hence the italicized there. take that italicized word in the paragraph that it's in home as an assignment. All right.
The entire scheme of universal creation and evolution on all experiencing levels is apparently a matter of the conversion of potentialities into actualities. And this transmutation has to do equally with the realms of space potency, mind potency, and spirit potency.
Just they're challenging you to go beyond, you know, thinking just the material where you have the space potency, you know, the finite presence of the unqualified absolute, you know, and then the spectrum of primordial force and emergent energy and, you know, that. You know, they're just pointing out you have three reservoirs here, so they all start with a potency, a potential, space potency, mind potency, spirit potency. Threefold actuality is obviously one of the things they really want you to get. And you notice how they mentioned that the triodities as being a key there, the transmittively associated. In other words, that's really the way you understand how the absolute gets transmitted down to the finite. And those two triodities are threefold. Matter, mind, spirit, potential, matter, mind, spirit, actual. You know, threefold actuality, you know, is what that downstepped from the absolute down to the finite looks like. It's not a singular thing. It's fundamentally this threefold thing that's downstepped. So they're just emphasizing that. They want you to really start thinking in the threefold actuality and potentiality mode.
The apparent method whereby the possibilities of the cosmos are brought into actual existence varies from level to level. Being experiential evolution in the finite and experiential eventuation in the absinthe. Existential infinity is indeed unqualified in all-inclusiveness, and this very all-inclusiveness must perforce encompass even the potentiality for evolutionary
possibility.
Must
encompass even. Yeah.
And this very all-inclusiveness must perforce encompass even the possibility for evolutionary finite experiencing and the possibility for such experiential growth becomes a universe actuality through triodity relationships impinging upon and in the Supreme.
Okay. Now that last little bit we'll pick up next time. But there's one very important thing that they're wanting you to be sparked to think there. If you're really familiar, you know, with the language in the book, when they say existential infinity is indeed unqualified, that should make you think of a sentence. Unqualified infinity. Remember, you know, when we start with the I am, and then we have that notion of what happens next. Mm-hmm. You know, the infinite one frees himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This is one of the ways that you understand, you know, you have the whole and the oneness separates itself, and the total will separates itself from the total deity. You know, the oneness frees itself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. Now we're talking about the Supreme Being. Extend that. See how the picture has a parallel. If, you know, when all is said and done, when the finite is complete, the Supreme Being is manifest. The Supreme Being, another He, just like the infinite He that freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity, here's a He who has finally freed himself from the fetters of unqualified supremacy. Okay? That's kind of the main reason that we're starting out our exploration here. That, you know, because the Father concept is, you know, is man's highest concept, that's where we're starting. That's where they start. And so to begin to understand that which goes beyond the Father, they start with that which is the most like the Universal Father, has the most direct parallels, and is the easiest to begin to grasp, the Supreme Being. Okay? The Supreme Being is right now freeing himself from the fetters of unqualified supremacy. You know, just like what happened way back before time began, if we could have watched that, you know, okay, spread out over time, you know, it would have been very similar to what we're seeing right now. What it looks like when the Supreme Being is freeing himself from the fetters of unqualified supremacy is what we're living in. That's the domain we live in. Okay. And so the Supreme Being obviously has a very, you know, many parallels to the Father. So we can begin to transfer our understanding of the infinite down to this, you know, the finite by just thinking about that parallel. That's why they're starting this way. That's a very easy little gentle step to take from where we start with our highest concept of God. It doesn't have God the Supreme. All it has is God the Father. It's like, well, let's start with the part that's not God the Father, that is very similar to God the Father. It's just that it's finite instead of infinite. And let's think about the parallels, and then we will begin to see the differences in, you know, as we do that. You know, and the more you think about what's different, the more you begin to see that which goes beyond God the Father. That was the whole process that we went through in going through total deity. Finding God the Mother, you know, specifically within it. You lay everything out, and it's like, okay, that's there, and that's there, and that's there, and that's there. And then you discover there's this piece left. You know? And it's trivially obvious what it is. See, so that's the process, that's what they're starting to do. It's like, well, first of all, of all that stuff that's not the Father, let's kind of get figured out that part that's real Father-like, just finite. Let's get that fully, get a grip on that, and then we can set that aside. Okay, now what else is there? They're peeling back the onion here. They're building up through these 20, we got 21 sections that are building up to the central section. We'll finally have peeled it away enough that we'll begin to see something very different than we've ever seen before. Something is very different than God the Father, but just as tangible. And just as overarching. That's the process there. You know, it's done evolutionally, right where we are, and then they're going to slowly move us forward. All right, well, can we wrap it up there? And so next time they're just going to continue on. They're going to kind of, you can already tell, they're kind of alluding to deity and reality a little bit. They're going to pick up on that. They're going to try to start with that initial suggestion, see? And get us to understand that. But what they really want you to do is sort of understand it and set it here in the pile of that which is understood, and then go to the pile that you haven't figured out yet and keep working on it. Keep sifting through it until you finally understand everything that's there.
You know, one of the nice things is that even if you don't understand it, in this life,
you're beginning a process. Yeah, that's the whole point. You're obviously not trying to complete something. You're going to eternity. You can't complete that. You're trying to begin. You're trying to really begin. You're trying to get both eyes open so that you can really begin. Now, that's the whole point.
It must be the seeds of this initial understanding have that kind of value. I mean, there's no reason from all kinds of perspectives for us to have to learn the Arantula. Right? So therefore, if it's here, why is it here?
Yeah. And we all know that you figure out something that doesn't seem to be directly related, but coincidentally, it will transform your life. Because it's giving you a greater universe frame. And that means the flow in that framework changes. There's a reformation of flow. It no longer flows like it used to. You've changed the frame of reference. And that will change everything in your life. You'll relate to everyone differently, everything. You'll begin to start to be able to understand how Jesus could do what he did. Even though you can't do it yet, it's like, but I get how, if I just keep going down this line, I can see myself, I could get to that point. Whereas initially it's like, well, it's a dichotomy. You know, there's Jesus and there's man. No, that's the Son of God. That's what you see with the laser beam. See again. Son of man. He's also the Son of man. You can do that because you have an adjuster. That's the problem with Christianity. Jesus told them that he was the Son of God and the Son of Man, but they forgot the Son of Man part. They just couldn't grok that. They fixated on the Son of God part. You know?
See, you really should have been at the council in Nicaea.
Let's not do it again. Let's not do it again with the fifth epical revelation. You know, why, you know, did he say he was also the Son of Man? What's the consequences of that? How does that change your universe frame and transform your life? How does that set you free from the old frame of reference that you had? You know, that's what we're trying to discover in this other Pentateuch. Yeah. All right. You have one more thing?
Let's wrap up, and then
we can talk about some things. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Announcement after.
Announcement. Yeah. All right. So let's just let's just take a moment here, and we'll do the announcements.